Creative Nonfiction Podcast is sponsored by HippoCamp 2018. Now in its fourth year, HippoCamp is a three-day Pennsylvania writing conference that features 50-plus speakers, engaging sessions in four tracks, interactive all-conference panels, author and attendee readings, social activities, network opportunities, and optional intimate pre-conference workshops. The conference takes place in lovely Lancaster, PA, from August 24th through August 26th. Visit hippocampusmagazine.com and click the conference tab in the toolbar. And if you enter the keyword CNFPOD at checkout, you will receive a $50 discount. This offer is only good until August 10th or until all those tickets are sold. There are a limited number, so act now. HippoCampus 2018. Create, share, live. Hey there, CNFers. It's the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I speak to the best artists about telling true stories, whether that's narrative journalists, documentary filmmakers, essay and memoir writers, or radio producers. I try to unpack their lives and their work, so you can apply those tools of mastery to your own work. I've been a fan of today's guest for quite some time. Today, for episode 108, I welcome Katie Baker to the show. She's a staff writer for The Ringer. Prior to that, she worked for Grantland.com, so there's a Bill Simmons continuity going on there. Her work often focuses on a singular subject, and she's one of those writers that when you see her byline, you know you're in for some fun. Naturally, I've linked to some of her work in the show notes. She's at Katie Bakes on Twitter. As Tom Petty used to say, don't bore us, get to the chorus. I hope you enjoy this conversation with the great Katie Baker.
You're working on these pieces. You're kind of on some deadlines and so forth. So I wonder, how do you set up your days when you're in the throes of a writing project so you can accomplish what you're looking to get done?
I guess first of all, I definitely, people would let the people close to me would probably laugh to hear me discussing process, because from the outside it correctly looks like a lot of chaos going on. But I'd say, in general, I just had a new story go up today about the Sacramento Kings, and it wasn't like a super intense, it wasn't anything. I basically had worked on it since, for less than a week. I went on Thursday to their NBA draft party and went from there. So I'd say kind of for something like that, a lot of it is just, I like to do things where I can include reporting, because anytime you can just go somewhere and be on the scene and look at details, and it can never hurt. It can only help. And so it was fun to, I just got back from maternity leave, so it was fun to do that again. And on a day like today, when that went up, now it's time to turn toward kind of the next batch of things. So there's, I have kind of different ideas and various levels of activation and optimism. So I'm kind of trying to do some organization and figure out how to prioritize those.
Do you generate most of your own story ideas, or are you getting them from other editors and colleagues?
I'd say it's a mix. I mean, I'm definitely expected to and do pitch occasionally, and kind of try to keep kind of a regular appearance on the site, even when I'm working on something longer. So if that means working in, maybe a shorter post here and there. But at the same time, they definitely direct a lot of ideas my way. There's kind of two hubs in LA and New York, and I work remotely from Northern California. So they're definitely having kind of creative discussions and planning meetings much more frequently than I am. So they often come out of those meetings with ideas, and I love getting ideas. I love getting assignments and ideas. I would say coming up with ideas is probably one of my bigger challenges versus just being told what to write about and just you know, digging into it.
What do you find the challenges of being or writing features and doing the kind of work you do remotely?
I think probably the biggest one would just be losing, you know, writing is already kind of a solitary activity when you're actually, you know, putting the words down, and, you know, mentally taxing activity. And whenever I do kind of go to the LA office for a few days or something, I emerge just feeling so creatively energized and confident and excited. And then, you know, I get in my own head for a week at home and I'm just convinced that, you know, everything's bad and everyone's mad at me. And, you know, I'm playing it up a little bit more than it is, but that would be probably the biggest and maybe even my only challenge. I think the other thing is that at The Ringer in particular, they do so much kind of video and audio work all the time that is also taking place kind of on the movie studio where the TV studios in LA where The Ringer is located. And it would be fun to be more of a part of that on a day-to-day basis, but that's the trade-off I make for not having to, you know, sit in LA traffic, I guess.
Right. And that, I think a lot of people, and especially me, can relate to that, you know, being at home as your main hub. And even today, personally, it's like my mind has been in mud. Like I just can't get anything going. So I was looking forward to speaking to you because this is my chance oftentimes throughout the week to have an interaction with a peer and someone whose work I deeply admire. And sometimes I find that almost all the time, I find that very energizing. And you kind of alluded to it too, like getting home, and it's just kind of, you can feel a bit lost and definitely lonely. And so how do you process that and cope with that so you're still able to get what you like done?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I've definitely learned to just be able to recognize it. And so it doesn't consume, like, you know, when I first, you know, I used to work in finance, and in 2011, I made the full-time switch to writing full-time. And I just remember just thinking how crazy it was that I had gone from working, you know, at Goldman Sachs in my early 20s and, you know, being worked around the clock and that sort of thing, to being a writer. And yet it was so much more stressful. I was I was having so much more anxiety. We had just gone through the big, you know, recession and crash, and it was a really stressful time at work. And even that didn't really like match up to just the ongoing, you know, stress and anxiety that I felt early on. And I think I didn't know what it was at first, but when the work is just so different. I went from a very, you know, it was still a people business, but it was much more quantitative. It was much more discreet in terms of numbers. Like, here's the work you have. When it's done, you're done. On to the next thing. And instead of, you know, a blank page and a blinking cursor. So I think the difference between then and now is that now I just kind of know that there's going to be those dark nights of the soul and those weird moments. And I'm much better at recognizing, like, you know what? I need to go to sleep right now. Even though I'm trying to finish something, it's going to be better for me to go to sleep for a few hours and then scramble to get it done than it is for me to just try to slog through the night. So, or, you know, just in general, kind of when I look at my schedule, I can identify kind of how the work is going to, like, what the workflow is going to be like a little bit better. And maybe that means knowing that on one, you know, day or one morning, like, I'm kind of resigned to the fact that I probably won't get a lot of work done. So I'm not going to torture myself about it. And instead, I'll make that a productive day in other ways. So those are some of the things that I've just kind of learned to do to kind of snap myself out of those moments. And I'm also making myself sound probably more doomsday than I am. But it really does get... There really are those kind of crazy times when I just feel like I'm typing through molasses and, you know, everything. I've been working on the same sentence for like 2 hours and I know that that sentence is going to get cut anyway, because I just know it's not, at this point, it's not even good. So, you know, it's good to have to have perspective on the fact that that's normal and that's going to pass.
And that's a big, big moment for you in 2011 from, you know, Goldman Sachs being on that sort of career track. And then, of course, you had some writing experience that you were doing on the side ever since you were a teenager. And so you always kind of had that muscle. What was the thought process as you were looking to make that transition to full-time sports journalism after being on a finance track?
As you said, even going back to when I was probably in like middle school and around that age, like I always was loved writing. Like even as a kid, I was always writing little books and poems and whatever. But as you said, I had that, I had that kind of going all the time. And I always loved sports and I was a big Knicks fan. And high school and college, I wrote for the, sports section of the school papers and all that sort of thing. So when I went to Goldman Sachs, it was for a summer internship, and I sadly had to turn down a summer internship at Time Inc. at Sports Illustrated, for college juniors. And I remember just crying over the decision. And so that was always in my mind. Definitely got very sucked into the world, graduated and went and worked there for, about 6 years. And in 2008, kind of right when things were starting to take a turn for the worse, that's when I started, someone emailed me and was like, oh, there's this new blog system called Tumblr. Like, you're always writing me these really long emails all day. Like, you should start a Tumblr. And that's kind of how it all started. From that point on, those next few years just involved me writing a lot more. I lived in New York City then, so I met a ton of writers. I just happened to live like catty corner from this bar called Tom and Jerry's that was like a big congregating point for a lot of New York new media blog people. They were people whose work I'd been reading since I was in college and stuff. So it was really exciting for me to tap into that scene a little bit. And it just increasingly made me want to do something other than what I was doing.
When did your Tumblr blog start gaining a certain amount of traction that validated that enterprise and side hustle that you had?
I had no concept of like how many people were reading or like page views or anything like that. It was more about like, oh my gosh, Alex Balk, like he liked my post, and to just see that writers who I admired myself and who were cool and who were, kind of engaged in this really interesting, creative, weird, insidery scene. So that was kind of a big part of it. And just meeting a lot of those people, IRL cemented that. But I'd say I would have to go back and look. I mean, it was probably when I started kind of like writing for Deadspin and Gawker and doing some freelance work that, I felt like I was starting to like, this is something I can do and get paid for. And so that was probably like in, I would say later, like it, 2010, maybe a little earlier, maybe like late 2009 by then. So
at what point does Bill Simmons reach out to you and start to essentially poach you from where you were to go to Grantland?
The Simmons history is kind of funny, because when I was my first year after graduating from college, I had a friend who was still in college, and he called me and said, I'm coming to New York City. Bill Simmons is doing a book signing, I think at the Riverside Cafe down in the Village. Let's come meet me. Let's go out for dinner and then let's go to the book signing. And this was his book. It would have been his first book, Now I Can Die in Peace. And we went and the line wrapped all the way around the block like once or twice. And we stood in line and it was great. We caught up and got to the front of the line, took a picture with him. It's actually kind of funny because Chuck Klosterman, I guess, was like probably sitting with him and visiting him while he was signing books. So he's like in the background of the photo. So it's just me and my friend Brian and Bill Simmons, and that was in probably like 2005, 2006. And then, you know, I'd say 5 years later, Bill wrote his second book, and he was doing a, you know, kind of media tour for the book, and he did a Q&A on this website called Mediaite that at the time had recently launched and was, I think, the first website to actually pay me to write. I remember they paid me, what was it? If I wrote 8 articles, they would pay me $500. So once I wrote like article number 8, I would get a $500 check. So that was my first contract, you know, and I was still working at Goldman at the time. So probably the only person at Mediaite that was covering sports in any way. So he noticed my writing then. And I think he reached out to the editor just to say, like, why, how come she writes so infrequently? And he explained why. And I think it piqued his interest. And we ended up emailing then. And I told him, you know, I was a fan. And that was probably the first correspondence. And then over the course of the next like year and a half, when he was starting to kind of launch Grantland or at least talk about Grantland at ESPN behind the scenes, he reached out and said, this might be happening, you know, and at that point it was kind of perfect timing to leave and start something new.
What did you learn from probably reading Bill's work, you know, for years beforehand? And then as you worked for, you know, his baby Grantland, like what did you learn essentially being sort of an employee of him, and how did your writing change and bloom from that?
Yeah. So I guess, first of all, from reading him, I mean, kind of same as anyone that came across him, you know, early on, just, it was such a different kind of writing with such voice and just opinion. And it's hard now because it's so kind of baseline for someone to write that way, but it was to have like the pop culture references and that sort of thing. Like I sound like a fuddy-duddy putting it that way, but you know, that stuff was just fun and funny. And it was the kind of stuff you would find on like news groups, which I was definitely really into at the time. So, you know, I guess just kind of the importance of voice and was probably something that, you know, sticks out to me from that. And then in terms of working for him, I mean, it's just incredible to me, like how much energy and motivation and like enthusiasm he has all day, every day, 24/7. I mean, it just exhausts me to even think about what his day must be like. And yet, like at the same time, if you send him an email, he writes back in like within the hour, and I just don't understand it. And, you know, so, and then, you know, just the way he really like wants to find and promote talent is something that, you know, I personally have obviously been part of. And he enjoys kind of finding and, you know, people when they're young and kind of unknown. And I think he's done that both at Grantland and at The Ringer.
And what did hard work as a writer start to manifest itself to you? And I say that in a sense that it's, some people equate it to just hours in the chair or word count or just interviews and everything, setting up things. And I wonder how maybe like witnessing, maybe like how he went about his work and maybe some of your peers at this sort of high level of writing and journalism, like what did hard work start to look for you, and maybe how did that redefine itself, and that so you were able to apply that kind of rigor to your own work?
I guess this is sort of not answering your question, but setting up a little, is just one thing that was important at Grantland, and that is definitely kind of always, you know, I always remind myself of it at The Ringer, is how much of it is based on just people's weird random enthusiasms, and about how they encourage us to write like 10 articles about one thing if that one thing is the most important thing in the world to you and you can do some kind of obsessive deep dive, you know. So I think just finding those things and seeing the way other people kind of claimed them and owned them and cultivated them is something that sticks out to me. I mean, that's less about the actual like writing, but just a broader point. So, and then writing wise, I think it's just honestly just seeing how much work we have. Such an amazing editorial staff, from our, you know, kind of bigger picture editors down to the copy editors and fact checkers that we extremely thankfully have and encourage. Seeing just the how much work they do and how tirelessly they work is always motivation for me to, you know, try to envision just how much is on their plate and to, you know, try to make working with them that much easier. Mm.
And something I've noticed with your work for a while is that a lot of the profiles you've done are these very singularly obsessed individuals, whether it's a Mike Keenan or Mike Breen, Alex Rodriguez, Annika Sorenstam, Ovechkin. So you get these super laser focused people. And I wonder if that, like, what is the draw for you when profiling people of that nature?
I always have kind of empathy for things like, I don't think people often think enough about what it really means for a professional athlete to have gotten to that point and just what their lives, you know, there's obviously always exceptions, but what their lives have looked like and how distorted their lives have probably been, whether they're a superstar or just kind of a run of the mill player. So, and then the true superstar is obviously like, people are all different, but it's interesting. I mean, someone like Annika Sorenstam, she can't even really, you know, she can't really even like explain her greatness, but you can kind of like circle your way to approaching it. But you're never going to like, how could she? Like, it's just, it's her life and it's like who she is, you know? And I love anyone that's just like, Mike Breen is just so passionate, and his love for listening to the radio kind of launched him into now the voice of the NBA. But at every step of the way, he was just like a broadcasting nerd. And so kind of stripping back the layers of who he is today, and it's not like he's changed much. I mean, he's still the same incredible, kind, smart, funny guy, but stripping it back and you know, talking about that guy when he was a kid and, you know, in New York, is always fun to do. You know, when the conversation, you know, not every subject is gonna sit through that or is gonna want to, but when you can have a subject like him or someone like Ovechkin, who, you know, I've never sat down with one-on-one, but there's just such a rich tapestry of threads to pull when it comes to him, and doing research like that is always fun for me.
What I love about the people of that nature, and I had this conversation with on the podcast about a baseball coach. He's written a couple books that I think apply to the arts as well as hitting. And he was always saying, this kind of goes back to the rigor question I was talking about earlier. And he was like, all right, you've gotten to this point and you're pretty good. You think you're working hard, and then you take a step up in class and then you realize you really haven't been working hard at all. And that levels you up. And so that's what I love reading about, you know, a lot of these profiles you do. You realize that even Rodriguez, who was a prodigy, and then you realize the degree of work that he was doing to maintain it, take the PEDs out of it. He still has to work his ass off. You get a sense of...
Yeah, and seeing how that turns into him being like, you know, calling his broadcasting partners every night and asking them for feedback, and they're like, go away, go call J-Lo. But it's the same kind of obsessiveness. I mean, the leveling up thing is interesting, because I will say one thing I love about reporting and about, you know, going and being on scene is like, you really do just see how dogged and how good at their jobs, like some of the beat reporters are, or the national, you know, NBA reporters or whoever it is. And just, it's kind of crazy when you see kind of how hard they're working and how they're constantly doing something and how they're always looking for an angle. And it's a tough environment. And that some people get super competitive about it. And, you know, there's definitely moments where those things play in, but my mandate at those events is always so different than, you know, someone who's in those positions that there's not a lot of overlap, but at the same time, it is kind of inspiring and motivating to watch, you know, the real pros kind of operate.
Yeah. What kind of, do you have any specific takeaways that come to mind where you see that degree of hustle and then how you can apply that to some of your work that kind of comes after the headlines hit?
Yeah. So one thing I learned relatively early on, just kind of by observing, is I would just notice that a lot of times some reporters would wait in the locker room for so long. And, you know, locker room reporting is its whole own topic, but that's how it is right now. And it's awkward, you know, it's inherently awkward to be in someone else's space. And, you know, I always just feel really dorky kind of standing in the middle of a locker room while, you know, kind of like not trying not to make eye contact with anyone, but also trying to look like I'm working. But also some of that work just involves kind of standing around. but I just noticed that people would just linger and linger and stay, and the room would be empty and they would stay. And I never really understood what they were doing. And then I kind of just started hanging around and kind of realized that, I guess, you know, the way the rules are, it's like every athlete has to technically be present at some point. But what some people do is they shower for, you know, an hour and a half and then kind of sneak out. But just a lot of times you could really catch people. And a lot of times it was kind of major people. Just by waiting around, you could catch an interaction where the owner comes in and talks to the player, and you're kind of standing right there. So that was definitely like one tangible thing that I saw and that now I kind of try to do if I'm not on any sort of like tight deadline, which I'm usually not. Is just kind of hang around, and you have to, you know, I at least have to go against all my instincts of being done and not feeling awkward, but it often can yield some cool stuff. And, you know, and then other stuff, just like being at the Olympics was probably a big one. Just seeing, I mean, people just are working their asses off 24 hours a day, and then there's the athletes, you know, and it's just seeing people like Bonnie Ford, you know, how she takes an event and turns it into a beautiful column, and just the way she, without even necessarily needing some sort of special access. I mean, a lot of times it's just her in the media scrum, just, you know, asking a thoughtful question. And so those are probably environments where I've kind of started to, you know, learn from the real pros.
And working remotely, how have you honed your capacity to do a reported piece, but over the phone?
Yeah, I've just kind of had to. I mean, a lot of times that's what they offer anyway. It's not ideal. I think what I've started to try to do, and this goes for in person too, but just generally, is to do so much prep work and read so many interviews that whoever I'm talking to has already done, that I'm not wasting the first 7 minutes of a 10-minute conversation on, you know, because I mean, the worst thing that happens is when someone tells some great story and you're like, oh, like, this is great. Oh, this is going to be my lead. And then, you know, then you go to do your kind of research a few days later when you're writing the piece, and you realize that's kind of their token story that they've already told to other people. So getting that out of the way first can at least make the phone conversations like more targeted, or, you know, at least trying to find like extra details that I can't find in a Google search. But it's tough. I mean, one of the biggest positive changes was just this little, I bought like a better recorder. And then I bought this earpiece that just goes in your ear, so I can talk on my cell phone and it records my cell phone just through the earpiece. Like, it doesn't even plug into my phone. It plugs into the recorder. And so that thing has like changed everything, because I can go sit on a park bench and do the interview, and, you know, or I can be driving, and, you know, obviously I'm doing it safely, but I can you know, I can basically like pull over, you know, start talking and then record everything. So that's kind of made it better. So I'm not just like sitting around all the time, waiting by the phone.
Wow. And what is the name of that device?
Yeah. So I can see. Okay. So I used to use this thing that was this pen. It was so awesome. It was called, I think, like the Live Scribe Echo Pen or something like that. And it was this pen, and inside the pen was the microphone. And then you had special paper. And as you wrote notes, it connected the notes to whatever audio was going on at the moment. So later on, you could just click on the notes with the pen and it would start, you know, you write down, you know, talks about his childhood, and it would start at the point where they were talking about their childhood. And I love that thing so much. And because it was a pen, and I wasn't like using it in a sneaky undercover way, but I think people would kind of forget that, you know, it wasn't like a giant recorder right in their face. Mm-hmm. But then they made all these like terrible updates to it and made it, turned it into like a Wi-Fi thing. And so I was really upset. But now I have kind of a pretty good setup where, okay, this earphone is called Olympus TP8 telephone pickup microphone. It's like $15 on Amazon. So I use that. I record things. I often send them. There's a transcribing website called, I guess, Temi, T-E-M-I. And it's just like a robot, and you send the files. And so the transcriptions are super rough. And if the sound quality is not good, like you can pretty much forget it. But I just send it to that. And then it comes back with a digital, you know, website. And it's kind of the same thing where you can click on the words and it goes exactly to that part of the audio. So you can kind of get like the rough outline of what the conversation was. And then when you need the exact quotes, you need to listen back to that exact moment, it's easy. So that's kind of been my new process that's been working really well in just trying to, you know, and it lets you highlight quotes and stuff like that. But yeah, I mean, just I downloaded Scrivener once because I've heard such good things about it, and I've still never used it. And I want to like be that person that's organized and uses it. And I don't know if I ever can be, but I think I still have it on my computer somewhere.
I see. And earlier you said that you have a, you know, usually some mixture of short and long stories going to keep, you know, the shorter pieces to keep you present on the website, but the longer ones that are kind of simmering. And I'd love to dig into your sort of how you keep, maybe like a how you keep that stuff straight, and maybe where you, you know, you said like coming up with ideas is something you kind of struggle with. So maybe do you have an idea file and something that you revisit and hone, and, you know, so that way you always have sort of a constant churn of stuff you're working on?
Yeah, I'd say, like, you know, especially when I came back from maternity leave, I kind of, you know, had kind of a big, fresh group of ideas and stories. And then there's some that are just kind of, you know, the constant like white whales that, you know, will just never stop trying. Like, I mean, A-Rod, the A-Rod story I wrote was actually kind of one of those. I mean, I'd wanted to write about A-Rod for so long. Yeah, I have a file. My editor, Mallory Rubin, who's a genius and is unbelievable and is one of the people I'm mostly talking about when I talk about just the tirelessness of the editorial staff. But, you know, she's good about kind of drawing that stuff out of me, and especially when it comes to kind of the short-term stuff of, you know, is there anything you want to do this week? And then the longer stuff, I mean, to me, I've kind of gotten to a place where I think it works to have a file of ideas. And then, you know, to sometimes you get to a point where you're done with a big idea piece, you're trying to figure out what's next. And you just have to kind of try to reach out to someone on every idea and see if anyone says yes. And so I've gotten a lot better at you know, handling those rejections and realizing, I think it's a sales thing where they say, you know, you try to get 10 no's a day or something like that. And if you're getting 10 no's a day, you're probably at least getting one yes a day or two yeses a week or whatever it is. But so I try to think of like immediate, you know, inquiries and queries to potential subjects or to representatives in sort of that same style.
And what did your career in finance teach you about the type of journalism you do?
I guess to some extent, working outside of journalism before working in journalism generally can be just a useful thing in terms of, you know, seeing the way the world works or the companies work or how the media is covering your company and whether they're doing it well or poorly. I guess other beyond that, just probably I've always been a research minded person. So, I mean, I used to approach my work the same way as I do my writing when I would be doing research for clients or writing presentations. So, and, you know, even at my old job, I was often kind of the designated like proofreader, and just because that was always something that was in my skill set.
Do you have maybe a 3 to 5 like favorite books or articles that you routinely reread as a way to remind yourself how a certain type of storytelling is done?
I'm not someone who necessarily revisits the same. I mean, there's definitely things I've read again and again, but actually it just popped into my head. One thing that I do read again and again, because it's my reminder of just the joy of what a simple, perfect blog post should be, is I want to say Alex Hurd wrote for Slate years ago about how, and it was like it was pegged to the Masters, which I think was coming up that weekend in golf. And he just wrote this post about how golf is the perfect sport to nap to. And it was just this short little essay. And I read it like every year when golf season begins again. And that to me was just the perfection of the internet and internet writing, and just so influential to me kind of in the, you know, the mid 2000s. So I wouldn't normally like start my list with that, but since it was in my head, and then, you know, in general, writers that are, you know, I literally say to myself, when I'm working on a piece, I think, well, what would Brian Curtis do? Who's one of my colleagues at The Ringer, mm-hmm. Whose work is just so good and so vibrant. And I love his level of kind of detachment yet engagement. Jessica Pressler is another one who I feel that way about. I always try to, when I'm getting really stuck in the weeds on something, I try to take a step back and say, okay, if Jessica Pressler was writing about this, how would she be doing it? And then, you know, kind of more broadly, I've always loved kind of creative nonfiction writers. So, Ian Fraser, John Jeremiah Sullivan, you know, I don't think I've ever read any of David Foster Wallace's fiction, but I've read like all of his essays, his nonfiction essays. And so those are things just to remind myself of like that voice and about the fun of reading things when they're written well, because I often get very bogged down in just like feeling like I have to explain everything instead of just skipping, you know, moving things forward. So yeah. Those are probably some influences on me.
Yeah, that's outstanding. That's kind of reassuring, I think. I've been in a similar boat where in anything I'm doing, I try to actually like, I put on like the hat or the mask of someone I admire, just like you're mm-hmm. kind of saying, and be like, all right, how would they work their way through this? And then it gets me past my own, my own shitty view of my own work. And like, yep. it allows me to get something that is at least semi competent and readable in front of me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I have, I don't know where it is now because I've moved offices, but I have this like painting of an iceberg that I try to keep near my desk because it's a reminder for me that, you know, people just like see the tip of the iceberg. Like they don't see what's under the water. Like they don't, it's like the duck swimming. Like they see the duck, they're not seeing your legs working furiously. So they don't care and they don't know whether you've, you know, torn your hair out over something or whether you didn't care about it. They just are reading what's in front of them, and maybe that'll come through or not. So I'm just always kind of reminding myself, like the reader's just reading this, like the reader doesn't have all these mental hangups that you have. And the reader hasn't seen all these drafts. The reader doesn't know that this sentence embarrassingly enough given the sentence, you know, took you 45 minutes. So it's good to reset that way sometimes to think, okay, what would a Brian Curtis thing would feel so light here and my work right now feels so heavy. So how can I make it lighter?
A weakness I tend to have, especially with really long stuff, essays and even book length stuff, is I have a tendency to be to overwrite or to try to be too clever, too funny. And it's always something I have to rein back in. And I wonder for you, what might you struggle with in early drafts that you feel like, all right, Katie Baker, I rein it back in, like, you know, and what might some of those things be?
It's unquestionably just doing too much research, like doing more research as a procrastination tool, essentially, mm-hmm. which makes me feel like I'm being so productive, and it makes me feel like I'm connecting all these synapses, and, you know, I start to become like a beautiful mind, like, oh, I read a sentence here that reminds me of a sentence there, and I can totally use that as a transition, and like, this is going to be so brilliant. And then it's like, okay, how many words do you have? Zero. or, you know, and then I sit there for two more hours trying to, you know, reverse engineer that brilliant transition into the piece when it probably doesn't even need to be there in the beginning. So that's undoubtedly, like, I mean, and I always know I'm doing it, and sometimes it does yield some cool information that makes the piece better. And I know it's kind of just part of my process at this point. So I kind of let myself go through that phase, but that's always my issue.
So is it one of those things, like, sometimes I ask people, like, when do they know they're done? And is it a deadline that tells you you're done, or do you finally have like a good clock to know, all right, finally I'm done with this piece?
I mean, nine times out of 10, it's the deadline. but you know, other than that, it's if I feel like I kind of know like what the like kicker is and what the, you know, the last three sentences of the first section or last three paragraphs of the first section or something, I'm feeling in a good place. I often have a hard time getting there. A lot of times it's just the deadline, or it's like I said earlier, I've gotten a little bit better at kind of recognizing like, all right, you know what? You reach that point where you just need to send this in, and then you can take a nap, and then you're going to fix so many of these things in your next draft. So instead of trying to tinker with it endlessly at this point, which is not going to help, like, you got to let it go. And I've gotten better at realizing I'm at that stage.
What do other writers, maybe younger or aspiring, or even people your own age or older, what do they come to you for advice-wise or questions and asking for, maybe a bit of wisdom given your experience with Grantlin and The Ringer?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's always just how I, you know, got to the position, and my answer is, you know, it's not really a traditional path, obviously, but I think it kind of speaks to just the fact that there's a lot out there to do, and you can always kind of come back to writing. And I don't know, I think the other advice I often give is, I mean, since I've identified it at Grantlin and The Ringer, I always tell them how important it is to cultivate your own enthusiasms, because that'll come through in your work. And you can just always tell when someone really cares and knows their stuff. And then, you know, how to break in, how to be noticed, which is kind of the eternal question. In my case, it did kind of, you know, fit the advice of do good work and people will find it. And that's obviously not always the case. And I was lucky because I lived across the street from a certain bar in New York City in the year 2008, you know, and that was luck. But the, you know, work I did in the early days and the late nights, like, that was the work part. So that's usually what they're asking. I mean, they are so much probably more like multimedia savvy than I am and have any hope to be. So there's so much more that's available to them and they can go in so many more directions. Whereas I feel like I, to some extent, and I don't feel like I only can do this, but I've sort of identified the type of work that I'm probably the best at, and limited it a little bit to that. But with that in mind, would love to branch out a little bit more.
Yeah. And what is the work that you feel you're best at, and what do you want to branch out and do more of? Just to piggyback on what you just said.
I think I'm best at doing, you know, long form work where I can take advantage of just like my eye for detail and my enthusiasm for like weird subjects or for just immersing myself in whatever culture it is I'm writing about. And then I think I would love to just figure out, I'd love to have the mindset of knowing what would be a good podcast or knowing, you know, this would actually be a really good, you know, YouTube video or something, this idea versus a written piece, and just trying to be more thoughtful about how to like present an idea to the world, because there's so much stuff that my colleagues do that is so funny and so brilliant. And I'm like, I want to do that too, but it's just not my immediate instinct to think like a, you know, podcast producer.
You know, what excites you and drives you still? And then to, you know, what about the work keeps bringing you back to the computer again and again?
It's so funny because like, if you asked me this yesterday, when I was finishing up a deadline and I was so crazed and I was so uncertain of this piece I just wrote about the Sacramento Kings. And I felt like I wished I had, you know, one more day or one more week, and I could make it so much better if I could only do this, or if I, anyway, and then today the piece is up and, you know, for the most part, people seem to like it. And, some people have even remarked on the fact that they can tell I put a lot of work into it, which is a really nice thing to tell a writer. At least in this case, I mean, maybe some people wouldn't want to hear that, but so now I'm like, oh, well, it's great. You know, I learned about this, you know, I talked to people and I went to a fun place and I love my job. And yesterday I would have been like, I don't know how much longer I can do this. I have no confidence. So, you know, there's that roller coaster, but, I think in general, I just, when I take a step back and think about some of the places I've been able to go and people I've been able to talk to and just seeing my own personal confidence levels in my reporting and kind of, I'm not naturally someone that likes to call someone on the phone unprovoked. And, it's even part of what I didn't like about my old job. And yet here I am. But I've started to just realize like the way it can pay off, like to just make those phone calls. And yeah, sometimes people are going to say no, or you're going to say something stupid in a scrum and people will laugh and all those things have happened to me. But I also just like when I can actually like see myself from the outside sometimes and I'm like, wow, you just like kind of went up to that person and asked that, or you just asked this question, or you just found this person's high school coach on the phone that, you know, no one else has, and they told a funny story. So those are kind of the little moments that are, you know, the probably the dopamine triggers that keep me coming back. But and just also always knowing that ever since I was a kid, like I love to write. So even when it doesn't feel that way, I just know that if I weren't doing it, I'd be doing it, you know?
Right. Well, Katie, thank you so much for carving out the time to do this. And thank you for your work. And I'd ask you just one final thing, where if people are not already familiar with you and your work, where can they find out more about you on the internet and get more familiar with you and your work?
Sure. You can find my work as well as the work of my extremely brilliant colleagues at theringer.com. And I'm also on Twitter at Katie Bakes. And yeah, if you're a sports fan, TV fan, tech, politics, you know, really strange esoteric discussions combining those things, then The Ringer is your spot. So that's where I'm pretty much all my work is.
Fantastic. Well, again, Katie, thanks so much for the time and thanks for the work, and maybe we'll get to do this again sometime in the future.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was fun.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Katie.
Hey, if you had enjoyed the show, let me know. I'm at Brendan O'Mara and at CNFPod on Twitter. You can also email me with questions or concerns. I'd ask that if you like this episode and others, that you kindly subscribe to the podcast wherever you get them and share it across your social platforms. You're the social network. I algorithm you. Also, please consider leaving an honest rating or review on Apple Podcasts. They go a long way. Head over to BrendanO'Mara.com for show notes and to subscribe to my monthly reading list newsletter. Once a month, no spam. Can't beat it. Thanks for listening, CNFers. Goodbye.